Now, the last group of drugs that we're going to talk about under this general area of drugs for inflammatory conditions concerns the drugs used in the treatment of asthma. Asthma is an inflammatory disorder. It's characterized by bronchiolar hyperreactivity, sometimes abbreviated to BHR, bronchospasm, an increase in the secretion of mucus, edema in the bronchial tree, cellular infiltration there. Early asthmatic responses, sometimes abbreviated to EAR, are associated with bronchospasm from the release of histamine and the leukotrienes. So, you know, some of our drug actions may be exerted to prevent the effects of leukotrienes, such as the drugs that inhibit lipoxygenase, like Xyluten, or the drugs that inhibit leukotriene receptors, like Zafirlucast. The late responses to asthma, or late asthmatic responses, include cellular events like infiltration of eosinophils and lymphocytes, possibility of more protracted bronchoconstriction than simply bronchospasm. A lot of mucus is formed, and there's a big increase in BHR. So the management involves like a two-pronged attack. One would be to use bronchodilators to provide short-term relief of an acute type of situation, and the other would be to use anti-inflammatory agents that will decrease bronchiolar hyperreactivity and hopefully protect against the cellular infiltration that occurs as part of the late responses. And among the drugs that we have available there are, of course, drugs that are fairly potent bronchodilators. In the last decade or so, bronchodilation by the use of beta-2 selective drugs that activate beta-2 receptors in the bronchiolar smooth muscle has become almost the paradigm for treatment of asthma. I would like you to remind yourself about some of those drugs. They were mentioned earlier under autonomic pharmacology. One way you might do it actually is if you thought of the word MAT, M-A-T. That would give you the first letters of metoprolol, albuterol, and terbutaline. That could be one way to remember that type of beta-2 selective drug. But there are plenty of them available for management of asthma. The shorter-acting forms in terms of inhalation are used for acute attacks, and usually those that are longer-acting are more prophylactic. For example, salmeterol, salbuterol are used, and they have actions that go for perhaps 12 hours and therefore tend to decrease the likelihood of a patient waking up in the middle of the night with an attack of asthma. Also, the longer-acting ones allow you to use less of other drugs. If you need more than a single drug, then they may decrease the requirement for other drugs that are anti-asthmatic. Mostly, these drugs are used by aerosolic form that does decrease systemic effects because you're breathing it in and breathing it out, etc. However, some gets into the blood. And the concerns you have there really depend on the extent of overuse of beta-2 agonists. Even with the usual precautions, including spacers, etc., people sometimes overdo it with a beta-2 agonist in terms of inhalation. That means then that you might start to get effects outside of the lungs. And when you do, you begin to get effects that actually would be very dangerous to the heart. See, the actions of beta-2 drugs theoretically should not affect the heart, but they're not pure. They also have activity on beta-1 receptors, and if enough of the drug gets into the blood, they then will become stimulatory of the heart. And there have been occasions where people have had severe cardiac problems because of that, including actually death from such stimulation. One of the early signs of systemic toxicity that's going to occur with inhalation of beta-2 agonists is a tremor. A slight tremor, because remember, beta-2 receptors at the skeletal muscle are activated by norepinephrine, and they'd be activated by a beta-2 agonist for that matter. So recognize that muscle tremors would certainly be part of the expression of systemic toxicity. Patients often become a bit anxious, you see, because as soon as you start getting effects on the heart, you think, what's gone wrong? You know, I can feel my heart beating. So they might get anxious as well. Now, the diagram here shows you what happens with respect to drugs that can influence bronchoconstriction. What we have here is, for example, the action of a beta agonist, which is through its beta 2 receptors coupled by a GS protein to adenyl cyclase, and one then increases cyclic AMP, and it's the cyclic AMP that it leads to bronchodilation. Now, you might also see here that on this side of the figure, or on this bottom half of the figure, that if you were to interfere with the metabolism of cyclic AMP, and we certainly have drugs that can do that, theophylline is a good example, you can inhibit phosphodiesterase. That's the enzyme that metabolizes cyclic AMP, converting it to adenosine monophosphate. So part of our useful action of theophylline in asthma is due to increasing cyclic AMP, not directly, but by inhibiting its metabolism. The mechanisms of bronchoconstriction, of course, concern three different types of endogenous compound. Acetylcholine through muscarinic receptors, well, that's what you get when you have excessive parasympathetic stimulation. That's what you get when you increase acetylcholine by a cholinesterase inhibitor. You actually bring about bronchoconstriction. Remember, in terms of the identity of the drugs that act by cholinesterase inhibitors, by the little term dumbbells. Dumbbells, as we've said already, actually stands for diarrhea, urination, meiosis, B for bronchoconstriction. So you can pretty much guarantee that that's what's going to happen. As far as adenosine is concerned, adenosine is also a bronchoconstrictor through adenosine receptors. And this then, of course, is part of our mechanism of action of theophylline. Theophylline blocks adenosine receptors and therefore would have an inhibitory action on adenosine stimulation of bronchiolar constriction. Lastly, the leukotrienes. The leukotrienes activate receptors leading to bronchoconstriction, and the leucast family, like, for example, Zafir leucast, will have an inhibitory action there. So the diagram actually shows us all of our drugs that actually lead to the acute, if you like, bronchodilation that is important in an acute asthmatic attack. Muscarinic blockers already have been described very extensively under autonomic pharmacology, although one has not said specifically which types of drugs are used in asthma. If you were to sort of pick one of the several that are available, I think ipratropium would be a fairly good example there. There certainly are others available. Remember that they're going to cause a bronchodilation in acute asthma, and they appear clinically to be very good drugs in patients who have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Some people recommend this class of drugs over the beta 2 agonists in patients who are at risk for cardiovascular stimulation, because they appear to be safer in patients who have cardiovascular dysfunction. In beta blocker overdose, where you might get a bronchospasm, you can't reverse that with a beta 2 agonist. Beta blockers always win the battle. If they're on the receptor, you can't get them off. So what you do in a bronchospasm caused by a beta blocker is give a muscarinic receptor blocker. This is an example of physiological antagonism. You're working on different receptors, and this is then puts this category of drugs into drug of choice for that situation. Do they cause atropine-like side effects? Well, if they do, they're very, very minor. It's not something to specifically worry about. You may get some dry mouth types of effects because obviously you inhale through that mechanism. Theophylline is an old drug. It's a methoxanthine, goes back a long way. It's a drug that for many years was a standard drug to use in the treatment of asthma, but has, you know, declined in use in a sort of inverse way to the increased use of the beta 2 agonists and the inhaled steroids. It's an inhibitor of phosphodiesterase and therefore should increase cyclic AMP by that mechanism. It also blocks adenosine receptors in bronchiolar smooth muscle. Remember, adenosine is a bronchoconstrictor. These days, I would say it's mainly adjunctive. It's got a narrow therapeutic window. You know, twice the effective dose or twice the effective plasma level gets you almost into the toxic range. So, you know, that's a fairly narrow window, and it has cardiovascular and central nervous system effects, both of them being stimulatory. So look towards an increased heart rate and look towards arrhythmias as far as the cardiac effects are concerned, and look towards behavioral excitation up to and including seizures with toxicity that is a CNS toxicity. More commonly, of course, and hopefully, GI distress might be one of the problems that people suffer here. Quite a few drug interactions with the compound theophylline. Many drugs inhibit its metabolism. For example, antibiotics like erythromycin and fluoroquinolones will do that. Cimetidine, the H2 blocker, is a very good inhibitor of theophylline metabolism as well. There is a form of theophylline called aminophylline, which you might have seen in the emergency room. It's an intravenous form that's sometimes used for bronchospasm. Now, what about some of the drugs that actually are more in the category of prophylactic or decreasing the bronchiolar reactivity? We have several mast cell stabilizers here that can prevent degranulation of the pulmonary mast cells, and that will then decrease the release of inflammatory mediators. Immediately, you know that mast cells contain histamine. You may not remember that they also contain platelet-activating factor and various leukotrienes, all of which are inflammatory mediators. So if you can prevent that release, you've got yourself something that could be anti-inflammatory. For the most part, we think of this type of compound, like chromalin, as being prophylactic. You see, they're probably best in situations of either allergen-induced asthma because of the effects on the mast cell, and to some extent exercise-induced asthma, but they really should be taken before you're exposed to the allergen, for example, because it takes time for them to work. If you've already been exposed, you already released these mediators from the mast cell, and you're not expecting to get too much of a response there. Overall, they're not particularly toxic. They may cause a repetitive cough in some patients, an irritation of the throat. Sometimes you can relieve that by a beta-2 agonist. A little bit of a beta-2 agonist, use a puff here and a puff there, may relieve that type of symptomology. The adrenal steroids as anti-inflammatory drugs have been discussed just in the past session. And therefore, I don't need to go through in detail how they bring about their anti-inflammatory action in asthma, except to remind you that they will decrease the synthesis of prostaglandins, leukotrienes, and interleukins, as well as platelet-activating factor. But I see prostaglandins, leukotrienes, and interleukins as being most relevant to the inflammation in asthma. And by blocking the release and synthesis of these things, they're going to have an anti-inflammatory action. Now, mostly we use glucocorticoids now by the inhalational route, and so we have what we call surface-active glucocorticoids. Beclomethasone is an example. Flunosalide is another example. I don't have a great preference for one over the other for your remembering about them, as long as you know that, of course, we do use inhaled glucocorticoids very commonly in asthma. They can be used in acute and chronic situations, and one can use these drugs both orally and intravenously in an emergency situation. Which drug would you use orally? Probably prednisone, actually. Prednisone tablets work very quickly in an acute asthmatic attack and actually would be something that many people would use independently of a physician's help to ease a problem in a child, for example, who has an acute asthmatic attack. Remember that if you use steroids, you usually have to taper dose after using them. In an emergency room situation, you probably would use intravenous steroids in an emergency situation, and not inhaled steroids. Inhaled steroids tend to cause bronchospasm, but either oral or intravenous do appear to be appropriate. Steroids affect, you know, the flora in your upper GI tract and oropharyngeal cavity, and can cause the elaboration of fungal infections like candida. And if you overuse them, you will get systemic effects. The best illustration I can give you for that is the one seen in children, where you can interfere with the development of their bone by overdoing it with an inhaled steroid. So they obviously do get in, and they can cause a slowing of bone formation. The last group, then, of the drugs that are working at the level of inflammatory responses would be the leukotriene antagonists. We already have mentioned these drugs to you, and Zafir Lucast and his family members are antagonists at leukotriene receptors, most notably the D4 receptor. They have prophylactic value in that regard, not only against antigen, but also exercise and even drug-induced asthma, like NSAID-induced asthma. They have side effects, diarrhea, headache, etc. is quite common with the Lucas family, and they have also been associated with an increased infection rate, upper respiratory tract infections. Xyluton is the only example at the present time of a selective lipoxygenase inhibitor that's been brought into medicine. And so this one will inhibit all the leukotrienes. It's not selective in the sense of leukotrienes, but it is selective in sense of affecting a eicosanoid enzyme. So it inhibits lipoxygenase, but actually interferes with the synthesis of all of the leukotrienes. Rapid onset is sometimes used adjunctively to steroids. The problem with it, if it is actually shown to be a serious problem in the long run, might be the liver toxicity. It has been associated with an increase in liver function transaminases. That, I would say, would be the most distinctive property about it. Lastly, then, as far as acute asthma is concerned in the emergency room, don't forget oxygen as the major requirement in patients that can't breathe. Aerosolic beta 2 agonists would be certainly on demand, as it were, and you'll be making that decision. Steroids intravenously, usually, I would say in that order, as soon as possible. Aminophylline is around intravenously for bronchospasm or in status. I would think if you could just remember the general sequence here in the drugs, I think you'd be in reasonable shape.